You're listening to the NetMums podcast with me, Wendy Gollidge.
And me, Jennifer Howes. On this week's show...
There's always people close to you who go, yeah, we thought something was wrong, but didn't want to get involved, wasn't our business, didn't want to sort of like ruin the family dynamic and say something when, you know, everyone has arguments, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, by knowing the correct steps to take, it could have saved... I mean, it could have changed mine and my siblings and my mum's life, basically.
But before all of that... Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode. I am feeling springy. It finally feels there's crocuses poking up, there's little daffodils poking up. I've got hope that spring is coming. And I've got two lovely guests with me today, but sadly no Jen, because Jen is off doing other things today. So today's guests are here to promote an incredibly worthwhile campaign for the NSPCC. Jim is a successful YouTuber, a writer, a model, and his book 147 Things is described as the user's guide to the universe, from black holes to belly buttons. Sarah's a model, and the two got married last year and have a little girl called Margot. They are here to talk about Listen Up, Speak Up, the NSPCC's campaign, which focuses on what every one of us can do if we think a child is being abused. So welcome to the show, Jim and Sarah.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Now, first off, at NetMums, we want to say congratulations on your wedding and on the birth of lovely Margot. How old is she now?
She's 17 months yesterday.
Yes.
Yeah.
And is she a twatty toddler yet?
Sometimes. She was this morning.
Yeah. She, do you know what? She's an absolute bundle of joy. She's super delightful. And even when she is a twat, she's also like very charming with it. But for the most part, we haven't like fully entered that realm yet. But she's got a thing where she just wants to climb the stairs all the time. And if you don't let her climb the stairs all the time, she will have like a meltdown.
No, the problem is when she does things and you're trying to discipline them, but it's actually really funny. So last night, she's actually a really good sleeper. We are so lucky. She usually kind of does 7 till 7. She sleeps like a dream. But last night...
Oh, bugger off.
Last night, she was just awake, wanted to hang out with us. And she was playing what Jim and I call silly buggers, where she pretends to cry. She's like crying, but then as soon as you settle her, she chats to you and sings. I knew there was nothing wrong with her. And Jim said, shall I bring her downstairs? She'll just sit with us for 10 minutes, calm down, and I'll put her back. She started singing and picking my nose and going, hello. I don't know where she's picked it up from. She's picked up this like cockney voice. So she goes, hello.
I love it.
And she's literally finger as far up my nose as she could jam it. And I was trying to like hush. I was trying to like grunt at Jim, stop laughing
I found it funnier than Sarah did. So I was kind of banished from the room.
Stop laughing. We're supposed to be disciplining. But actually you're there. Like you have to laugh.
It's even worse when they get bigger because mine's 11 and does stuff and I'm like, I can't laugh at this because she'll know I'm laughing.
Right.
Yeah, we have to take turns to leave the room to laugh because she knows. And both of us at this point, both of us were just in stitches and then she thought it was funnier. So picked my nose even more.
I love it though. Like the things they do and the way their mind works, it just every day is like a little tiny adventure.
Yeah, you know? I was colouring with her yesterday. She's got a little play table and we were colouring and she crawled round to where I was, opened the back of my jeans and looked in as if checking for a poo like I do to her and she went, nope, and then crawled back off.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear that you didn't have poo in your pants.
Yeah,
no, I didn't.
Honest, it wouldn't have surprised me if there was one, Sarah.
So what's day-to-day life like in the Chapman household? On YouTube, it looks gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, it's super varied because obviously we're super lucky that both Sarah and I essentially work from home-ish. You know, there's a lot of travel involved with our jobs. It takes a lot of diary management because if I've got meetings or I've got somewhere to be or Sarah's on set somewhere, if we both booked in on the same day, we're like, hold on, we've got a child. We can't do this. So it takes a lot of like in the evening, we'll go, right, tomorrow, who's where, what's happening?
Having a shared calendar was life-changing for us. We would suddenly realize, like, I don't know why we didn't do it. And the first kind of 2 or 3 months of having Margot was actually quite tough. Because it felt like that kind of like hot potato and like passing it to me, to you. And it was difficult. There was like no structure because we both went straight back to work. We didn't take time off. And then I was like going to a casting, but then I'm there like, oh, I need to breastfeed, but then where's the kid and what's going on? And then it did get to a point where we said we need to get some structure and management.
There's also a lot of like that guilt. I had a lot of dad guilt because obviously if I'm at home and I'm working from home, I'll be in my office writing. Now, that's really tricky because I could just close the door and forget about everything. But it's really tricky when you can hear your kid crying and you can hear your partner struggling, because you can only take 10 minutes before you lose your mind when the kid's just sulking in your face, right? So I had a real guilt about not being present when I'm semi-present just in a room upstairs. So then I would stop working and I'd come downstairs and I'd help out for it, but then you aren't focused on work. So actually you become less efficient at work and less good as a parent because you're neither here nor there. So we had to sort of come up with a plan where if I'm in the office and the door's closed and I'm writing, then you have to sort of treat it as if I'm out at, you know, a traditional working environment so that I can actually focus. But I still do feel terrible if I can hear her having a sulk or I can hear Sarah, you know, struggling downstairs. So I take long lunches.
Equally, I feel guilty if I say that, oh, I'm going to have an hour to myself. I'm going to go, I don't know, get my nails done. And I'll think the whole time, oh my gosh, I'm like, it's that thing that's programmed into you that you think, but I'm the mum, I should be at home. And that's not a reflection on dad and how good of a dad he is. You just sit there and think, I'm letting everyone down because I'm not feeding my child, changing my child. Like, why am I not doing it?
Oh, it took months to negotiate Sarah's hair washes. Like, I was just like, go wash your hair. Like, why are you making it such a big deal? She'll, but then I'm upstairs for an hour and a half because I've got to wash it. And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. I'll be okay. But then she, you know, it took months. And then eventually I had to say, do you understand actually what you're saying indirectly is that you don't trust me to have time alone with our daughter? And obviously that's not what she meant, but I had to sort of flip it on her a little bit. You know, I was like, all this guilt you're feeling about disappearing for an hour and a half to have much needed time actually is reflecting terribly on me, because is the way I'm reading it is that you're not allowing me to be alone with her. So as soon as I said that, she's like, oh my God, you're right.
But it's hard for mums because we're pre-programmed to not trust anybody else to be able to do
right.
It, even dad. And it's hard for dads to get their head around the fact that mums think no one else can do it.
Right. I mean, Sarah walked in today and I was holding Margot by her by her legs upside down. So, I mean, she's not far off.
So talk to me about the renovation. I love a project. What are you doing and what's been the biggest drama?
We did everything. So when we used to live in, we had a maisonette, which was this gorgeous flat, but it was upstairs and then up some more stairs. And I really didn't want to move out. And Jim was quite rightly so. He was like, logistically, where are we going to put a pushchair? You can't even get up the stairs into our house, into the flat, the building itself, let alone into our flat. And then where are we going to share a corridor? Where are we going to do this? How's this going to work? So we moved and we found this lovely house, but it was a bit of a doer-upper. And then as we started doing it up, it was more of a doer-upper.
We didn't realise how much of a doer-upper it was.
That's the law, doer-uppers, is that it's always...
Like in every house I've ever owned, I have bought one that didn't need loads of work, but a little bit, because I like a project, and also you can sort of then maximize your resale, et cetera, et cetera.
And you make it your own.
But we moved in and I started peeling off the wallpaper and then like the walls fell down and I was like, oh my God. And Sarah was heavily pregnant at this point while I was peeling lead paint off the banisters. So I sent Sarah away to live with her mum for a few weeks.
I think I stayed at my parents'. There was one point where I called my mum, because then we also had issues. Once Margot was born, we had things like the windows needed replacing. And then and it was supposed to just be in and out in a day, but then they smashed one of the panes of glass on a Friday. And they said, we can't replace this until Monday. And I was like, I've got a newborn. Like, what do you want me to do? And I called my mum and said, I'm going to get on the train with Margot and come and stay with you. And my mum said to me, she's like, I will never, ever say no to you. But at some point, like, what are you doing? Because you call me up every other weekend saying we've had a drama and it's not safe and I have to come and stay with
you. In hindsight, it wasn't ideal. So I think, and also like whenever I've renovated before, it's just been me and Sarah, or, you know, I've never had a little person to think about. So we did it at a rate of knots so quickly to get it done. But this was during a pandemic and it was impossible to get hold of anybody. So everything took longer than it was supposed to, and of course cost more than it was supposed to, which then delayed things because I had to wait for invoices to come through. And anyway, it just took forever. And then we finally moved back in was it like November, when we had the kitchen renovated. And now I'm just not touching the house ever again.
But you know what? It's wonderful. We've pushed out into our garden. So we have, you can't see it. And also can't, I always forget this on a podcast. I like describe things and I'm doing hand gestures and I'm like, they can't see what I'm doing. We have this really lovely little bit of extension that's got so much light in it. And we've kind of turned that into that's child zone. And that's where Margot's toys are. And it's in the kitchen. So I think a lot of time is lived in the kitchen and a lot of domestic tasks, you know, emptying the dishwasher or filling the laundry. I can still watch her and she can play and I can kind of cook dinner while she gets on.
I mean, it's about 3 months old, that area of the house, and it's already probably the most loved. Yeah.
Love.
Starting to show signs already.
But it's lovely and it is worth it.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, in hindsight, it was worth it for sure.
So let's talk a little bit about the NSPCC campaign. It's called Listen Up, Speak Up, and its aim is to help more of us play a part in preventing child abuse. Tell us a little bit more about it and why you guys decided to get involved.
For me, it made loads of sense. There was abuse in my childhood. And so when the lovely people kind of got in touch, it was over Christmas time because they had this campaign with some chocolate and this reached out. And I didn't have a contact there. So when they emailed me, I was like, let's go for a coffee and talk because I think there's more to be done here. So then we've jumped on it. And I think because I've got such a big audience and it's something I've spoken about plenty in my tenure on the internet, how long have I been doing it? Like 13, 14 years. A lot of my audience have been with me for a long time and they know about my previous existence, my childhood, you know. And so from firsthand experience, I just think when it comes to Listen Up, Speak Up, had that existed when I was young, it could have changed things drastically, you know? And all it takes, it's basically asking yourself, if not me, then who, right? Because you could see something and it could raise alarm bells, it could trigger something in you, you could think, that doesn't sit quite right, but it's none of my business, so I won't get involved. And it just kind of challenges that thought process and say, hang on, it's none of my business, so I won't get involved. But what if everybody else says that? What if nobody else sees it? What if I'm the only person?
NSPCC came over to speak to my husband and I was kind of in and out because they were at our house having this conversation. And I think a lot of people that get involved in the campaign, I know most of the other ambassadors that we met on the day, they have, similar to my husband, they've had abuse in their childhood or quite close to them. And it's such a personal campaign. But what really spoke to me when chatting to the NSPCC team is part of the heart of this campaign is actually it's challenging people like me who have had a lovely childhood and a lovely family who think, not me, it can't happen. You know, perhaps someone like Jim is more aware of it, or say the other ambassadors, because that's their lived experience. But you know, you think, oh well, it's not me, I live in a nice life, I do this, and actually it's everywhere to everyone, and we can all make a difference. And I think it's getting people to change their beliefs, and it's this really brilliant quick online training that it just kind of it's just challenging your way of thinking when you see things. So it's literally challenging that, what did I see, and does that seem right to mm-hmm. me?
It takes 10 minutes and it genuinely does take 10 minutes. It's super quick and it kind of drops you in a few scenarios and it makes you aware of a few things that you might question, and then how best to respond and what steps to take next.
Oh, I think that's the crux, is how best, because you always have the fear that what you've seen was just something inconsequential. And if you start that process of raising the alarm, you could be doing that family a huge disservice. But then I guess the campaign is saying that you could also be helping a child.
For sure. Yeah. And that's very much kind of the attitude. One of the big things that stops like an onlooker or somebody who sees these things from actually reaching out is the thought that, oh, that it might be nothing and you know, the family might get in trouble. But that's the entire point, right? Because if it is nothing, then no one's going to get any trouble. We all have bad days, you know, like that's
fine. It makes me think, my mum's best friend told her recently that she went to go and pick up the grandkids from school, and they pulled her into the office and were like, "We're really sorry, but we have to have a word with you because your granddaughter has been telling us, I don't really like it when granddad tickles me on the bum." And they have some sort of game that they play, and it's totally innocent, completely innocent. And she said, "Oh, I know, she's been really funny. They played this game, blah, blah, blah." And she said, and there was no harm done. And it became, it was like a joke. She said, "Oh, naughty granddad." And she said, "I'm glad that you pulled me in." And it was just, it then became just an anecdote that she then said the next day over coffee with my mum, no harm done. But isn't it better that that's been pulled up and checked than someone going, "Oh no, I've met their grandparents. There's definitely nothing wrong there."
Yeah. And very often it won't, it wouldn't even come to that. Very often it's, you might notice that a parent is struggling. Maybe they're a single parent and they just don't have the time and the capability, and they're at their wits' ends, and they might themselves be, you know, in a negative place. It's about providing the support for that parent and letting them know the options available to them, as opposed to chastising and kind of jumping in and like stopping it. Because, you know, it's very much about awareness and just sort of trying to like adjust the way you think and help and be positive, as opposed to, I think part of the thing people think is that they're going to report someone and the police are going to get involved, it's going to be like appalling and the family's going to get torn apart. And that's such a rarity. I mean, unfortunately, it does happen, of course, but and there are instances where that very much needs to happen.
They always say the last thing they want to do is to separate a family. That's like the last thing. When we spoke about it on our stories, I had quite a few people that are working child protection and child services, and someone wrote to me and she said, "I'm so glad that you verbalized it this way, because so much of my job is teaching people I don't want to go and take a child away from their family." And the last thing, she's like, "There's so many steps that happen before I remove a child from their home." But I think people think, "Oh, well, if I call the NSPCC, does that mean that that child's going to suddenly get taken away, or the child protection going to like bang on the door?" And there's so many steps that they take before
and I think
that
happens. This is precisely why we need as many people as possible to do the 10-minute training. In fact, there was a target of 10,000 people in
they've surpassed it already.
Yeah, it was that the first month they wanted, and they're up to 14,000 already. So they're doing incredibly well. But again, the more the better, right? Because if we can get the whole country doing this, then fingers crossed, you know, more and more children live happy lives free of neglect or abuse or, you know, anything. And the world's a better place, you know?
So, Jim, how has becoming a dad changed the way that you process what happened to you? And how has it affected you and Margot, and how you think about her?
I don't know if me becoming a father has changed that, because I think I've had so much therapy about it since, you know, a fairly young age. I like to think, I mean, maybe Sarah will as an onlooker will tell you more, but I like to think I had that under control. Like, I actually view my childhood as kind of a story of positivity in a way. You know, yeah, things happened and those things were awful. And my childhood was kind of like a fairly scary experience, but I've come to terms with that, and now I've learned a lot from it. And the man I am today, I'm a really gentle guy, you know. And
I think you're definitely a lot softer, and I would say the same with your brother as well. Jim's a twin, so they would have a similar lived experience. And if I watch your brother as a dad and you as a dad, you're both really hands-on, you're really kind and gentle and loving. And I think if you didn't know about Jim's childhood, you wouldn't have any idea. You would just think that's a really like in touch dad. And I think the same for John. You just think, what a great dad. Well,
I think both my brother and I have had enough therapy to realize that my dad behaved appallingly, but a lot of that was because of the way he interpreted things. He had MS, and I always think that he was a real kind of a victim of it. You know, like, my sister inherited it from him, and she's super positive and has a great mindset and is making the most of her time and is doing like all this cutting edge therapy. And, you know, my dad, from what I remember, he believed the world owed him a favor because it was killing him. But he also was a very violent man. I mean, he missed my sister's birth because he was in prison for armed robbery. Like he abused my mum constantly. And I think that I look at him as kind of like a cautionary tale in a way. I kind of, my mum and my big sisters shielded me from it as much as they could. But I think as a kid, you pick up on the environment, right? Like I would visit my friends' houses and go, hang on, why is your house not scary? Like if I have a sleepover here, why are you like all happy?
There's a lot
and
of
playing?
Things I think you're not necessarily aware of. Once you become a parent, you chat about how you want to parent, you know, choices you might make, things you might do, whether that's, I don't know, what kind of bedtime routine to, where do they go to school? And it's interesting when I talk about my childhood with Jim, and there are things, I can't even think of an example now, but there are things that I would bring up. And I think that's normal, that happened to all children. And Jim's like, what? That I has no concept that that's something that happened. But I think it's so lived for you that you don't, you're not sat there feeling like a victim thinking, oh, I never got whatever it is that I spoke about. You're just, you're happy with your lot. You live your life now. And we just.
It's really unfortunate, but it does happen to kids all over the place, you know, in all periods of time. You know, I'm not a special case because it happened to me. But again, I've had enough time with it and to think about it as an adult that I realized that my dad just had his ways and his mechanisms in the same way I do, but his were just very negative and very destructive and very aggressive. And as a result of, you know, all of the, I guess seeing my mum and my sisters nurture me, but also all the therapy I've had, I'm aware that he was his own entity doing his own thing. We just happened to be kind of collateral to that.
So can I ask, would a campaign like Listen Up, Speak Up have helped you, do you think? How do you think it would have helped?
I guess someone would have spotted his, I don't know, maybe we'd be at the park or we'd be somewhere or doing whatever, you know, but a passerby or a friend of the family or someone else would have spotted a sign, whether he, you know, he grabs one of us by the wrist too tight or he's, I don't know, I can't, you know, pick an example. Someone would have seen that and gone, okay, well, now I know what to do. I mean, you hear all these stories about people who come out the other end of abuse and then their neighbours or their friends go, yeah, we thought something was wrong, but we didn't want to interfere.
I'm not going to tell their story, but one of the other campaigners had mentioned that they had gone through abuse and their neighbour said to them, yeah, we heard noises, but we just didn't know what to do. And that's the perfect example. And they really said, I really vividly remember the neighbours saying, I heard noises. And I think they felt a bit of anger about it, but I've obviously come to terms with it. And I really hope that this is the campaign that in that situation, the neighbours would know what to do and would speak to someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, precisely that. I mean, there's always people close to you who go, yeah, we thought something was wrong, but didn't want to get involved. Wasn't our business. Didn't want to sort of like ruin the family dynamic and say something when, you know, everyone has arguments, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, by knowing the correct steps to take, it could have saved. I mean, it could have changed mine and my siblings and my mum's life, basically.
So let's move on to talk about the joys of social media. We hear lots on the NetMums forums about parent shaming that goes on. Mums on their phones in the park or in the cafe with kids and they get abused for not paying attention to their child and things. You obviously, social media is part of your job. What are your thoughts about that kind of shaming and have you experienced it yourself in any way?
Can I answer this one? Go on. I have a really strong feeling on parent shaming because whilst I don't have as large a following as Jim, I do have a following and share a lot about motherhood. And it is the most bizarre thing to me that it's not just on the internet. It's at the park. It is at the music group I would take my daughter to. It's at soft play. And it's mental because I honestly believe that, I mean, obviously we're here talking about child abuse, but I do genuinely think that most parents, I'd like to believe that most parents have good intentions. And, you know, you're a parent yourself. I'm sure there are so many things that you do or have done with your kids that I might go, oh my gosh, why did she do that? But my thoughts are, is that child happy? Is that child healthy? Is that mum sane? Because we've got to preserve our sanity at the end of the day. So if, take for example, cry it out is such a controversial thing. Now, I will admit that we did cry it out. And I'm sure that I will get chastised for this on the internet because people think all their different thoughts on it. But you know what? Our daughter sleeps really well. And I'm a more sane mum for it. And I think I'm a better mum. Now, I'd rather you didn't judge me because I'm not judging you if you're still co-sleeping and still feeding and doing that stuff. Because I think, are you sane? That helps you survive the day. And is your child happy and healthy? And if we're all happy, healthy and sane, then who gives a fig what anyone else is doing?
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah,
you have. I was writing a note there because I agree so much.
I actually kind of warned my audience at the beginning of the process when Margaret was born. I said, listen, I've been sharing my life for the last, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 years, whatever. And my journey has grown with me. You know, my audits have grown with me. A lot of them were 15-year-old girls when I first started. And now I get stopped on the street by people in a very similar situation to me. They're 25, they're 26, they're 30, and they've got kids. But I said to them, I like my daughter more than I'm going to like any of you ever. So if I post online and you don't respond the way I deem appropriate, I'll just pull it. She'll no longer be online. And that's that. And actually, I can't share her enough. I have to stop myself because my audience are so joyful. It's different for me, I think, because I think mum shame is much worse than dad shame. So my social media is usually met with just pure joy. People go, oh my God, you're such a good dad. I'm like, I like to think I'm a good dad, but actually I'm a dad that's just there. I'm lucky that I like to think that pretty much every dad who would be there and has a job that I have would have the hands-on time with them. And I think it's just the fact that I'm a lucky dad as opposed to being a particularly good one. You know, I get more time with my kids, but my social media is actually full of positivity around Margot, and that's lovely. And I want to post constantly, you know, like how every other parent who just doesn't happen to have 2.4 million followers online will share their kids constantly because you're a parent. That's what you want to do.
I wrote an article about this and I found the stat for the amount of, I can't remember what it was a while ago I wrote it, but it was hundreds of thousands of pictures are shared by one family in like the first 5 years of their life because the parent is like, oh my gosh, look. And I literally said to Jim the other day, I was like, I can't remember what our daughter said or did. And I looked to her and I said to Jim, do you think every parent looks at their kid and thinks, you are the most amazing person I've ever met? Oh my God.
Of course they
do. Everyone's got the press. We've got Einstein right here. Like you just think they're amazing. So you want to share. I would say we have had so many chats as parents about online safety for a child, how we can protect our daughter. And
well, I was about to ask, will you ever stop sharing her? Yeah. Is there a point where
it's a passionate subject and it's hard to talk about because the people that feel strongly about sharing your child on social media feel so strongly about it. And there are they're not like, you know, shouting into an echo chamber. They do have valid comments and we'd be stupid to ignore them. I like to think, to echo back to what I said before, is that child happy and healthy? And my child is still happy, healthy. Mm-hmm. She is absolutely safe. I would never put my child's safety under.
I think a lot of it is that she's kind of attached to our hip at the moment because she's by necessity. And so wherever we are, she is. And I've said that my job is kind of my life in a way. That's the stuff I share. There'll be a point where she's no longer attached to my hip. And so she's not next to me all the time. And I think that's when we'll start pulling back.
I've noticed a pattern of a lot of people starting to pull back sharing their children once they kind of get to an age where they're a bit more recognizable, their personality's a bit more kind of on show. And I think for now, we're kind of happy with where it is. And she's a lovely little soul and we do a lot together and we show her. I do think as she gets older, she's her own person and it's not for us to share that on the internet. She can find herself in her own way.
There's also a huge concern that I have about like being famous too young. I fell into what I do, but I was in my early 20s at the time. And again, I've had loads of therapy, and I wasn't suddenly Jim Chapman, you know, I mean, didn't suddenly have loads of followers. It took a long time. And I pride myself on my work ethic. I turn up on time, I say thank you, you know, I'm really polite. If I get stopped on the street by someone who wants a photo or something, you can't expect the same of a child, because they don't know any different. And if suddenly they're getting stopped and stared at, they're gonna start believing the world revolves around them. And that's a very dangerous thing. And also it can't last forever and it's not maintainable. So at some point they're gonna have a very rude awakening. And that's something, for the sake of any child, but you know, my child in particular, for the sake of their ego and their sense of self and sense of worth and their mental health, is really, really important that they don't believe them. This is the thing about social media that I've discovered. It's very easy to think you're the center of everything, right? Because you post your own content, you edit your own content, you reply to comments about yourself as yourself. You're the boss. And I know so many people in my position who are ruined by it, because they just believe that they are God's gift. They just believe the hype. And actually, I've worked very hard to make sure that I surround myself by people who will not tolerate that from me. You know, I say it in jest sometimes and I make a joke about it, but they will pull me up on it. And that's my management. That's the clients I work with. That's my family.
My family called
your Jim wife,
Jay.
My wife. Yeah. Yeah. They call me Famous Jim.
My
but
family
it's a joke.
Called Jim as a joke, like completely teasing him. They call him FJ for Famous Jim, because my parents, it was actually my aunt that coined it. They live in the States and they came over to visit and they were like, I find this really weird because there have been articles about Sarah and Jim on the internet, which we've read, but I have no clue who he is. So it was almost to like tease him that they went, oh, you're so famous, Jim. FJ, FJ. And then they couldn't believe it. We went out and we were at Christmas.
Nothing
Christmas
like family to these, ground you.
Right.
Yeah. And these teenage girls came up and were like, you're Jim Chapman. And my aunt's, they lost the plot. They were like, he actually is famous. Oh my God. And they couldn't believe it. And then it became a thing that they were like, oh, Famous Jim. And now, out of a joke, my family call him FJ.
Yeah. But back to Margot, like, it's very important that, listen, if I can help her in some way as she gets older and is looking for a career, then of course I absolutely will. But for the time being, there's a point when a child starts to understand who they are and where they fit into the world. And that is when, for me, it's very important to safeguard Margot's development as an individual in the world. I can't deny her social media, because that's how kids communicate now. Like, you know, she'll be socially literate. She doesn't have it, but I'm not going to have her on mine with all the people watching. I'll let her sort of figure that stuff out with us as like guidance. And that's incredibly important to me, because I feel like I've witnessed an entire generation, because when I started doing this, it was adventure and it was chance, and I happened to be the right place at the right time, and then was the right guy to make it into a career. But I have seen so many people come and go. I've seen people rise and fall. I've seen meltdowns and breakups and all sorts, and I don't want Margot to experience it at that level. I would like her to be like all the other kids her age, going through it, figuring it out. And I think that's really, really important. And I also think, like, beyond me having loads of followers, it's a tough thing to figure out for kids regardless, because it's an entirely new way of communicating that actually defies a lot of all the social norms and laws that we pick up as human beings when we communicate. So it's really important for me that she also likes going outside. I've started like growing things in the garden. So, and I take her to the compost heap and stuff, and like we play with the worms, because it's really important that she has time away from that. And even she doesn't really understand screens and things, you know, or social media to that extent, but I want her to have these moments now so that it's something that's sort of ingrained in her, to not constantly be looking. And I'm really careful as well to not always be on my screen when I'm around her.
So what's next for you guys?
Well,
we are actually expecting another baby.
Congratulations. When is your baby number two due?
In the summer. So we are in the second trimester now, thank goodness, because I've been sick as a dog. Luckily, it's not as bad as with Margot. With Margot, I had hyperemesis really badly. And I was really nervous when I fell pregnant again about how I was going to look after Margot. And just, I mean, it's debilitating. You just vomit nonstop. And I was quite ill again this time around. I did lose quite a lot of weight and was quite kind of sickly. But it's kind of petered off now. I still get mornings. Like this morning was not a great morning. The other day I had to go to bed and just lie in bed. But mostly it's kind of evened out now, thank goodness, because it was a rough ride. I was really, that's the one thing. Do you know, I spoke a lot about hyperemesis with my last pregnancy, and I've had a lot of women contact me and say, are you frightened about having another child because of it? And I never thought I was until I then saw that I was pregnant. It was like this moment I looked at, you know, you look and it says on the stick, pregnant. And I suddenly thought, oh my God, I'm going to puke. How am I going to care for my child? What am I going to do? And then the fear kicked in, but actually it was much more manageable this time. And it's just joyful.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's also a very different pace this time. So when Sarah was pregnant with Margot, it was pandemic, and our first babies, we weren't already looking after Margot at the time. So time just stood still. And also, like, at the moment, like, Sarah's not even showing much. So as a dad, I'm not connected really to anything. Right? So I'm just looking at Sarah going, there's no bump, there's no nothing. I was looking at the app going,
apart from the sick bucket.
It's the size of like a cherry at this point. I'm like, hurry up. Whereas this time round, Sarah's already through the first trimester, and it has flown by because we're constantly chasing after Margot. And then suddenly I'm like, oh my God, another week's gone by, you know.
It has gone so much quicker. But I do think, and obviously because it's very odd how your phones just listen to you and they know things, which are just a little bit creepy. But I have started to get loads more kind of content on social media about child number two. And that's
terrifying.
Yeah, that fear of like, will my child...
I keep getting stuff about electric lawnmowers because my husband was talking about electric lawnmowers.
Yes.
He's scintillating the stuff that I'm doing at the moment.
But it is that fear of that kind of, will both kids be okay? Will my first child be okay? But also, is the second one going to be okay because will I have enough love for them? But is the first one going to be jealous and feel left out? And you feel kind of a bit of a push and pull, and they're not even here yet.
It's the best bit is when you're kind of like 38 weeks or so and your toddler is in the phase of dropping things on the floor and you have to keep bending down to pick the thing up, and you can't even see your feet, let alone bend down. So that's the best bit. And then they just, you know, she'll poke the baby in the eye a couple of times.
Oh, she definitely
send
will.
It back, and then she'll fall head over heels in love with it.
Yeah, I think it's nice. And I think it's nice they'll have quite a close age gap. So hopefully they'll be little pals and play together. And we kind of felt like, well, we still have the energy, especially when you realize it was like last night when my daughter was just playing up, and usually she sleeps. And it kind of occurred to me, I was like, we're going to be here again in a few months' time. And I'd forgotten, because I've gotten used to putting her down and having the evening to myself and sleeping through the night.
Yeah. You also forget how sturdy, like, Margot is. Like, you know, I'm picking her up and throwing her around the place. And, you know, I forget that a little tiny newborn is tiny and fragile. And, yeah, it's going to be really hard to have, like, two sort of different energies, you know, because I'm, like, really fun dad with Margot, and we get up to mischief and we cause trouble. And then, obviously, with the little person, I'm going to have to sort of be like, oh, my God, you're tiny.
You'll be surprised how much changes with number two. It's amazing how much more robust number two ends up being to number one.
I know. I can imagine looking back now, there are things that I look at as, like, a first-time mum, and I laugh at myself. I think things I wish I'd known. I remember, like, Jim went to the gym and he came back and went, you left me and I've been desperate for a wee the whole time and you've been gone. And he's like, why didn't you just go? And I said, well, what if the baby rolled? And he said, she's like 3 weeks old, she's not going to roll out of, just leave her there. And I was like, no, I can't leave her in her cot. What if something happens? And now I think, oh my
God. Yeah, there'll be none of that this time. My second child's first food was pizza. Knew her by me, might I add. I came into the room and my older child was eating pizza and had just given given the baby a slice of pizza, who, and she was merrily sucking on a pizza. So less precious, definitely less precious. So my last question for you guys is, Jim, which is your favourite of the 147 things?
Oh, that's tough. I have a thing about belly buttons, which I have discovered is more common now than I first realised. I hate them. I can't touch my own belly button. Margot's umbilical cord was a real struggle for me, especially, you know, like the first like, couple of weeks when it goes, essentially just rots off. It's horrendous. And I said to Sarah, like, there was a limit to how many nappies I could physically do because I was so grossed out by it. I was like, as soon as that thing drops off, tag me in. But anyway, it's called omphalophobia is the official name of it. I can't touch. Margot's is probably the only belly button out there.
When you came out with your book and you were doing like book signings and stuff, did people come up to you and say, I have the belly button?
Well, they hadn't read it then because it hadn't been released.
But have people since come up to you and said, like, I have the belly button thing too?
Yeah, yeah. It's not common and it's totally irrational.
Really? You surprised me.
But it's not as rare as I first thought.
Your sisters have it.
My sister used to, yeah, and now she's kind of gotten over it, I think.
It's hereditary.
It's really weird. But yeah, knowing that I'm not alone with the irrational fear of belly buttons is probably one of my favourites.
Well, thank you guys very much for sharing your morning with us. For any listeners who would like to find out more about the Listen Up, Speak Up campaign, you can go to the NSPCC website and we will put the link in the show notes as well. Congratulations on your news, guys.
Thank you.
Good luck in removing the sick bucket from your life, Sarah. It's coming. I can feel it for you. It's coming. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.